Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I'm the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And as a quick reminder to those that are joining us live, if you'd like to, go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find a link to the chat room. And we already got some of the usual suspects rolling in there. That's a great place during the course of the show if you want to exchange a few ideas or if you had an observation or two you'd like to share. Just go ahead and pop right in there, and we will join you as we deem fit, and we'll steal any good ideas you might throw in there and take them as our own. Also, if you're new to Midrats or you need to pop out, want to come back in, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio. Or if you use iTunes, just go ahead and go in the iTunes podcast system, and you can get it there. And, oh, okay, we had some technological problems, but I guess it's fixed. Good. Otherwise, I'd have to do my intro all over again. But anyway, let's get on to the show. We're doing something a little different today. Believe it or not, it's amazing. We are having our 250th episode of Midrats. That's almost 5 years that we've had the pleasure and the honor of coming on every Sunday and sharing some thoughts with you. And I guess it's a great opportunity, really, if for those that are listening that have been guests here before, to thank those that have taken time out of their Sunday to go spend with us and our listeners and to visit with us for a while, for an hour usually, sometimes a little bit less. We really appreciate our guests who have come on over the last 250 episodes, because that really does make Midrats the interesting stop for our regulars who come through. And we kind of like our format that we're just going to keep going today, but we're not going to have any guests. We're going to have one of our little open mic, open mind free-for-alls, which is Eagle One and myself, maybe to talk a little bit about the latest news going on, maybe a little bit about some things we've talked about before, and also an opportunity for those of you who are interested to call in. Maybe there's a topic we've never covered that you wish we had, or just a question you wanted to ask Eagle One or myself. We do have the phones open and available. You can call the switchboard at area code 347-308-8397, 347-308-8397. We would love to hear from you. And until then, Eagle One, thanks for 250 episodes.
Oh, it was my pleasure, and I haven't gone back and counted, but I really think that given the live episodes, we're probably on about 100 episodes, and the rest have been best ofs.
Yep, we've got a good mix there, and I think it's funny when you look at some of the best of episodes. I don't think we've done that many best of, but yeah, we've done quite a few. It's interesting. I've gotten a couple of emails over the years where people have gotten the best of and have been kind of angry that we didn't tell them that we had had this episode in the past. They wish they had listened to it a few months before. So always try to tell everybody, if you miss an episode of Midrats, well, that's your fault, not mine. I think, and a lot of our long-term listeners will know, that we went, I think it was almost a year and a half without our show being up on iTunes. I'll avoid everybody the technical details, but we had a little bit of an asymmetric war going on with Apple. I think we declared an aggressive and bitter truce, and we're back up on the podcast, because I know a lot of our regular listeners found getting the archive through Blog Talk Radio made it a little clunky, so they missed some of their shows that way. So for those that are tuning in who didn't listen to the beginning of the show, if you haven't made sure and resubscribed up on iTunes for the podcast, that's a great way to do it. So it just automatically goes to your smartphone and you can listen at your leisure. I know when we first started the show, originally we had Galvin from Information Dissemination. He was the third leg of our stool for a co-host for a while. I know that he catches the show usually on archive and gets it during his commute. So that's always a good way to get the show. And I guess if we wanted to throw a topic out Eagle One is, what's top of mind, some of the things I'm looking at starting the week on. And we've covered this topic before, and it's kind of fun to see it in the news. Though I still consider myself a young pup, I'm really not. And I cut my teeth as a little kid on the last little bit of the Cold War, and one of the episodes of the latter stages of the Cold War that was really entertaining is we're kind of having an echo of this weekend. I know a lot of y'all that have been following the news have seen that Sweden is having a graduate-level course of the pitfalls of coastal ASW. For those that aren't familiar with what I was alluding to earlier, you can just Google Sweden whiskey on the rocks, where the then Soviet Navy, one of their diesel submarines, got the Red Banner Fleet Navigator of the Year award by running up on some rocks in a neutral country. And there are some rumors that there's another Russian submarine who might be having some technical difficulties, so to speak. And we'll see how that evolves going forward. So did you feel young a little bit when you heard about the Russian submarine getting stuck, or did you have a good giggle at the reputation of fine Russian engineering?
Well, a little of both. I mean, as we talked about a little bit in the pre-show, I mean, that the whiskey on the rocks was 33 years ago, and that's a long time. There are probably people listening to us that weren't even alive then, but some of that was taken away. Some of my nostalgia was taken away when they had a picture of the Visby out there operating during the anti-submarine operations, and back in the old days, we had no ships that looked like that, so that changed things a little bit.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about it, and had me starting to think, the Visby's a new ship, and I've always been a fan of the platform. And the Swedes were a medium small country. They do produce some really good weapons. I think the lessons that we learned in Afghanistan, the Swedes were still making a new production recoilless rifle that we got our hands on in Afghanistan. We loved it so much, our special forces started to use it. And I read a few months ago that it's pretty much going to be standard kit now for our army. Because back during one of the army's little transformational fits, the recoilless rifle, the image of the from the World War II in Korea on the back of the Jeep. Oh, that's old technology. We don't have any use for it. But it's definitely cost effective when your only other option is to call a tank or to use a, geez, how expensive is a Javelin missile? I don't know. But I'd be interested to look at the Swedish ASW kit that they're bringing to bear in a search mode. Obviously, if there's a poor Russian skipper who's trying to figure out how to get his ship working before they run out of O2, can hopefully get underway and get back home before they reach some type of terminal status. But the technology from an ASW perspective, whether you're looking at search or whether you're looking at the terminal end, not much has changed since Whiskey on the Rocks. I don't think the computers have gotten a little bit stronger. There's a little marginal increase in your recognition deferential if you're going passive. I think computers have helped on the active side of the house, though I don't know how much Sweden has investigated in that. Looking at what's happened in the intermittent 30 years, there's a few sexy things above the water surface that has helped the ASW search. But below the water, we being the West, I presume, we've kind of taken a little bit of a acceptable risk of investment. Can you think of at least under the water what you've heard in open source is some of the promising ASW technology, especially in the, if I can use an overused phrase, the littorals or in coastal ASW? Are we pretty much treading water where we once were back when that old whiskey decided to go crunch?
No, I think we've made some advancements. And I was the other day, I was looking at the Navy Research Lab website, and they have this autonomous. I mean, there are mini submarines, basically long range AUVs which they said would be capable of doing ASW. I mean, it hints at it without shallow water ASW, which, of course, is really challenging. So, you know, I think that's a promising development, and anybody wants to look at it, it's at the Navy Research Lab's Acoustic Division. And they said they sent this thing along the U.S. coast from near Boston down to New York. So, you know, that's a long 315-mile trek with this thing underwater. Pop-up occasion where it was, but kind of an interesting development.
Yeah, I think one thing about ASW is it's probably pretty good that we don't have much to talk about in open source, because that historically has been a very, very touchy area that you don't want to show too much leg, because when you need it, you don't want to give your opponents the ability to counter it. I just hope that a lot of the technology that we know of behind the cipher door, that we continue to aggressively test it in as realistic environment as possible, because there is another history in ASW that I always like to keep top of mind, is when they developed really good depth charges before World War II, they thought that would be the end of the submarine. When the Hedgehog came along, they thought that would be the end of the submarine threat. When the homing torpedo came along, they thought that would be the end of the threat. So there's always that technological race, and I don't think anybody can think, hey, this is a war-winning technology. When we have to flip the switch, we'll be able to sweep the oceans of that threat. Submarine guys, they're too geeky, they're too smart, and they're too good at their work. I'll never underestimate them. But we've actually got a couple of callers online. And, hey, then we don't have to think of questions and stuff and come up with them earlier. So let's go ahead and take our first
call. That's why we usually have guests.
Exactly. Area code 703, welcome to Midrat.
Yeah, hey, Sal, you got me?
Oh, we got you. Who are we talking to?
This is Bill Paisley, Pinch.
Hey, Pinch. Thanks a lot for calling in. I caught you right before I got off of Facebook earlier because I realized you're right. I can't ask people to call in if we don't give them the number. What can we do for you today?
Yeah, hey, I probably, you know, there's so many things that we can talk about. I did a little, you know, Navy birthday day post there on Facebook and kind of grumped a little bit about a number of the things. One of the things that's really on my mind right now is this whole Hunter Biden deal. I don't know if you guys have talked about that or anything, but it kind of obviously gets back into one of those things about why we serve. And, you know, people like you and me and many, many, many others in the Navy and throughout their career, everybody's got their own little reasons and things like that. And this whole thing that that Hunter Biden went through, you know, going through 40 years old, 40 plus, whatever he is, lawyer, wanting to get what it looks like, just a check and a block for probably political reasons or something like that, wanted to get a little bit of a Navy bit onto his resume. And but then you throw in this whole thing about he gets bounced after a month after popping positive for cocaine, before really he even started. I mean, that's just incredible.
Yeah, and you kind of covered it, Bill, and it's an interesting topic, and I want to kind of shuffle this over to Eagle One, because he has a good experience with the reserves. But just for a lot of the listeners that might not be familiar, Hunter Biden, the son of Vice President Biden, went in the Navy reserves as a PAO. He got a couple of waivers, one of which was for his age. I think he's 43 or so. And on the whiz quiz, he popped positive for cocaine. Any guy who's 43, if you're still doing blow, you probably need to grow up. But on top of that, this might have been an opportunity if he was still doing blow to get over it. I got to feel sorry for him and his family. Very embarrassing. And hopefully he'll get the help that he has, because if you're 43 and you're doing blow, you probably have other issues going on. But Eagle One, I mean, the reserves are kind of unique in respect. You do kind of get the land of misfit toys. In some areas, a lot of people who decide that they want to serve, but they're later, you have a lot of support staff structure. How does somebody like Hunter get into the Naval Reserves and as a Naval Reserves PAO? And are they really value-added, or do we see some of these princelines that find their way into reserves for a variety of maybe interesting reasons that, you know, do they take paying billets from people who might be more value-added, or is he the exception vice a not uncommon rule?
Wow, tough question. I don't think, first thing is I don't remember serving with that many princelines, as you would put them, because since the all-volunteer force, a lot of those, you know, there was not as much pressure put on people to have served either in the reserves or some other area. But when I do recall seeing them, they were all in, usually in some kind of fairly high-level DC unit that gave them visibility. In this particular case, I mean, you know, here's a guy who gets in. He's over 40. He's got already got a drug waiver to get in. He's got an age waiver to get in, and then apparently somewhere along the line, whatever he's been doing has totally blown up his brain process, so that, you know, well, yeah, I'll join the reserves and I'll do some drugs, and then, you know, if I have to pee in the bottle, gee, I wonder what will happen. So you know, I don't think, you know, the Navy Reserve does all the same drug testing and stuff that the active force does. I'm totally baffled by what this individual thought he was doing, or why he thought he would get away with it. But you know, obviously the reason it took, seems to me, that it took as long to process him out might have been that high level interest in his particular case. They must have really made sure they had all the evidence completely locked up and down before they showed him the door.
Hey, Pinch, I had a question here for you. I always like to throw things back at my callers when they call in, just because I'm interested in it, because we've been kind of lurking around and watching your work for a while here. A couple of questions for you. Pinch, what are you reading right now, and what are some of the topics in the national security or in the Navy media, whether it's on Dead Tree or whether it's little talk shows like this, you wish people would pay more attention to because you think it's important, but just not getting enough discussion or enough intellectual effort behind?
Well, I think, you know, and one of these is, I think, obviously out there on the forefront, and it's a couple of the comments that I think I made in that Navy birthday post that I did. One is the, you know, where's the big 40-pound brains in the Navy thinking, you know, strategically in terms of our ships, you know, and what we're doing with the LCS and you know, and carriers, where we're going with our carriers and our air wings and things like that. I mean, it's there's a lot of people out there scratching their heads wondering, you know, what the heck are we doing? You know, we spent so much money. You know, and I've been in the acquisition business here in one way or another here in D.C. for about almost 15 years now. Now I'm working with Navy Modeling and Simulation. I've been with them for about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years there at the Navy Yard. And the thing that they always talk about, that we always try and talk about, is how, you know, M&S and things like that are a big deal in terms of saving money. And you stand back and you take a look at it, and you really wonder where they get that idea. Any money saved just gets spent somewhere else, so there's not really any kind of savings there. So that whole, you know, military acquisition world is still a head scratcher. The this whole thing with DOD in terms of you know, and they've got the same problems. When the Secretary of Defense comes up and says that climate change or global warming, whatever you want to call it, is one of the biggest challenges that we have, you got to kind of sit there and scratch your head about that and say, you know, where are you getting this? We've got a resurgent Russia. We've got all this stuff going on with China and in the South Pacific and all sorts of things like that that are really direct challenges to what we do and what we want to do, not only with the Navy, but with the U.S., you know, foreign policy and, you know, sort of strategic way of thinking of things. And yet we're sitting there, you know, wondering about that. The Secretary of the Navy is talking about green fuel, spending, what is it, $25, $28 per gallon for this kind of fuel that they want to use for the ships. you know, as opposed to the regular five or six, you know, especially when the U.S., with all this fracking technology going on now, we're able to get more fuel out. This whole concept of, you know, peak oil has been shot down. So there's just a whole lot of things out there in terms of the leadership, not only Navy leadership, but DOD leadership. A lot of people are really scratching their heads over saying, you know, where's the good thinking on these things?
Yeah, I think it's, as in most things, you can have, it all goes back to leadership and priorities, and many times leaders get their priorities from their bosses. And until you get that change, it's pretty much what we're going to have to stick at. But the good news is things like that gives people who sometimes enjoy a good snark a chance to make a smart-alecky comment. So it gives us topics to talk about. Vince, we've got another caller on. Really appreciate you calling in. And, hey, don't be shy. And don't be
a
stranger.
Thanks a lot, Sal. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks,
yes, sir. Thank you.
See ya. Bye.
Hey, our next caller, area code 661. You're on Midrats. Good afternoon. Hello? 661. I know you're there. Going
I think the trouble is you got two 661s. Both of us with the same number. Interesting.
Okay, the person I'm talking to who is not Eagle One. You're on Midrats.
Can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah, sure can. Who are we talking to?
Oh, boy. All right. Hey, it's Matt, guys.
Hey,
young
Mr. Matt?
Young Mr. Hipple.
Indeed. Well, I wanted to tell Eagle One, one of the things we're talking about ASW is at the Warfare Innovation Conference over at Navy Postgraduate School. They had, have you heard about the underwater garage?
The underwater garage. Oh, do tell.
They're literally, so they're going to put this little charging station underneath the water, and it'll be hooked up to this, that, and whatever thing, so that you can just run these little UUVs out from this garage. I'd imagine it makes more sense for, like, demining operations, but I thought it was pretty amusing. Most of us were concerned about, you know, what happens when someone finds this garage and then blows it up. But it's still kind of an interesting idea of taking a lot of this infrastructure and kind of forcing it under the sea. But what I really wanted to call you guys and talk about was, so Sal, you and Holmes now are engaged. I don't know if you'd say call it a debate because you kind of talked about it, but this Coastal Artillery Corps, where the Army's talking about what I think really is a push towards what you mentioned, that A2AD capability. Maybe what you guys thought was the future, that the Army has all these flat-bottom boats. I mean, those have been up to Kuwait, have seen the huge piles of them, and they're everywhere. It seems kind of like an interesting capability that's like a no-duh. Like, why isn't this something that we've done before, where we can deploy these guys all over islands and stuff and create our own little A2AD environment? What do you think is the future of that, and how likely is that to be a successful doctrine that the Army embraces?
Sure. Well, the illustrious Dr. Holmes, who has been a guest like you on Midrats before, yeah, he kind of tweaked me behind the ear, and I kind of grumped at him because he didn't include the last half of my statement, which I think I'll run with. Well, first of all, going back to coastal artillery, there are a couple of, at least from my perspective, if I was emperor, a couple of entering arguments. Nothing is allowed to be static, full stop. During the Falklands, the Argentinians got lucky with a little redneck engineering on a static Exocet launcher and got one of the Brit frigates. The more effective are the mobile launchers, simply because it makes counter-targeting a little more challenging, a little different. I would feel very sorry for an active duty officer in the Army who got selected for coastal defense. In my humble opinion, that would be as exciting as a career path is, no offense intended to my Zumi brethren, being an ICBM officer. Oh, for the love of God. I'd probably be in good shape because I'd PT myself to death to stop from going insane. That being said, I think if we really wanted to go that way, the primary route that I think I mentioned would be smart is look at our allies and partners who really have that. We don't have that need here unless we're going to start lobbying poons and the drug runners, which I don't think we're going to do. But we have allies and partners who really could use this capability. Let's go. Let's take east from D.C. and talk about a few. Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia really could use that capability just to complicate the Russians a little bit. I know the Poles are already making moves on it. Our Swedish friends have a great missile, a great turnkey operation that they would probably prefer to use, which I think is good because it brings Sweden close to them. You can click along. There are a few nations, UAE, I think we probably wouldn't mind having a few. The Israelis can take care of themselves. When you're going east, you're looking at Japan, Vietnam, even South Korea, Philippines. That probably could use that just to complicate potential aggression from the Chinese or even the North Koreans, just to make things a little more complicated. We could help them with that. If we wanted to have that own technology inherent, I think that would be a great way to utilize the Army Reserves. Have it be a reserve unit. I think that would be a very reasonable thing to do if you wanted to maintain at least a legacy capability in that. Make it something that you can drive onto a C-17. And if we wanted to make a statement, you know, you could park a U.S. unit next to a Chinese, next to a Taiwanese or Japanese unit, and kind of not different in concept, that is, to how we work our Patriot batteries. I think arguments could be made, is that really an Army mission? Traditionally in the U.S., it is an Army mission. But I think that might be an approach that we could use if we wanted to have that type of capability. And I do think it's a capability we could get reasonably inexpensive if we were going to use off-the-shelf technology. I know we talk about the follow-on anti-ship cruise missile, but it's really not making shadows on the ramp yet. So, start with what we got and move from there. I think I also touched on the ground-launch cruise missile. I think one of our sea lawyers might want to look at whether that's really going to impact some of the old Cold War treaties or not. But it's an interesting concept, but in an era of decreasing defense budgets, I would rather see our allies and partners do it, and maybe we can help them with the development. Eagle One, what's your perspective on that?
Well, you know, it depends on – this is going to get into a definitional fight, because if coastal defense means – you know, I don't think we're looking at coastal defense like during the Civil War or World War One, or even – the stuff we had set up during World War II. If you're talking about the THAAD systems, the counter ICBM or other ballistic missiles, that's a whole different ball of wax, which the Army's already heavily involved in. So, they've got THAAD, they've got a whole bunch of other stuff that they are working on and on which they're actually deploying. So, it's going to get down to a definitional issue. Now, If you're talking about a simpler concept, port security, harbor defense, things that we have done, some of which occurs because the Army is heavily involved, and that is one of their mission areas, but also it overlaps with mission areas the Navy and the Coast Guard have, then you've got a whole, we're going to have to draw some lines here and decipher what that all means. So I'm not, without better definitions of exactly what we're talking about, and I haven't seen any great topic of this in detail. All I've seen is kind of a general, Hegel says maybe this would be a mission for the Army. Well, it's already an Army mission. The question is, what exactly, at what level are we talking about doing this? And I'm not sure if it involves those fixed defense and those old forts I wandered through at Pensacola and other places that were meant to keep the Spanish away from our shores, or if it's something else completely. So, I think we've got to work on that issue.
Yeah, I don't know. I got a message from him earlier, but we have a one of our old regulars, Mark Stenovich. He was a Marine Corps artillery guy. I would love to talk to him, because when you look at when was the last time an American coastal defense unit or a unit functioning in coastal defense had a tactical impact, first thing that leaps to mind with me is the Battle of Wake Island, where you had some Marines, or the Army, I'm not sure. Somebody will yell at me because I got it wrong, that turned their artillery to sea, and they kept the Japanese at bay. They actually took out at least a mission kill, a couple of Japanese destroyers. So if you are having something coming from the sea, that it's nice to have that ability. So it would also be interesting to know U.S. Army, U.S. Marine Corps artillery units, when was the last time they did a little thought piece about, okay, what if we turn our tubes the other direction towards the sea? How would we do that? Because it's a little bit different. But 155 millimeters coming at you, regardless of the warhead, is going to ruin any modern warship's day if it came their way. Matt, you're a ponderer of the unusual. What are your thoughts on that on the coastal defense discussion?
I like the idea. Because it keeps the Army in play. It shows that the Army. I mean, I realize that part of it's probably, hey, they see air-sea battle, they see the Pacific pivot, all these things going on, and they realize what's coming. But it shows an ability to play ball that I like that flexibility, maybe something, an idea that we didn't think that they would bring forward. And, I mean, why not? If you have that opportunity and you have that kind of flexibility, if I have an Army, which is going to be big, and it has all these damn boats, why not? There's nothing that says that this would eliminate other capabilities or take away from other capabilities. You teach someone how to operate a land-based mobile system. That's pretty compatible with a lot of other training that they do. Launching missiles, okay, got it. They have a lot of missile systems that they operate. That seems compatible too. And then you say, all right, you're going to have some amphibious aspects here. Awesome. Well, you've already got a pile of boats that you operate in the first place. So it doesn't seem like it's straying too far from the path of things that the Army has. And if I'm going to take seriously major threats like the ones in the Pacific or create, like you said, threats for my opponents, different kind of capabilities they're not used to, this seems perfect. Why just go down the conventional path and say, I'm going to look for a naval or an air option to this? I don't think. You know what? I would bet that the Chinese or the Russians weren't thinking that we would bring up something like this as a capability. And maybe it'll make them think twice. Who knows?
Hey, let me throw a hypothetical by you. As a former PC in the naval sense, not in the political sense, as a former PCXO, let's say in a parallel universe, you actually found constructive work as an exchange officer with the Swedish Navy on one of their Visbys, and you found yourself outbound from Stockholm to do a little bit of the coastal ASW in a Visby. From a very, very small unit perspective, for a Visby, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, it's somewhere size-wise between an American PC and an LCS, but it has a nice little multi-mission modernized package.
And
it
looks way scarier.
Yeah, what are your thoughts about, and people think Visby, they think anti-surface warfare, perhaps special ops, but ASW is in its mission. From a small ship, small crew doing ASW, what are those top couple things that come to your mind as a small unit leader if that message came in and you had to go forth and do that, that would have your mind focused in a peacetime context, which is where we are. Just curious, wanted to roll that your way.
Well, I mean, the PC is not really a platform that's designed in any way, shape, or form for an ASW mission. We could fill the back and all the boat deck with sonobuoys and kick them out the back, which seems like a good enough plan, driving around at 35 knots, dumping them out for somebody else. But it seems like the best thing with small is to build things that would be a waste of money for a torpedo. Not a waste, but it's, I think Admiral Rowden said the distributed lethality, and Wayne Hughes talks about that distribution of forces, is that if you wanted to use small ships, you would build small ships and if you wanted them to do for this ASW mission, you would give them the ability to deploy things for other platforms. So I'm kicking out sonar buoys. Is a submarine going to waste one of its torpedoes on a 173-foot-long gunboat? I'm not sure, but, you know, I'm deploying capabilities that'll let somebody over the horizon dump an Azeroth on them or something from the sky on them. It seems like that is the best kind of, I mean, why not? One of the things with the PCs that drives me nuts is the Griffin, because it has such a short range and its targeting equation is so complicated. A Brimstone on there, probably a little bit better. But give them a little more robust surface capability. Give them a big, I mean, one of the advantages of LCS, I know a lot of us don't like LCS, but it has a lot of space on board. Give a little PC some space to put a whole bunch of stuff, either ASW or VVSS equipment. And so it gives you that kind of flexibility where you can go out and you won't do the mission yourself. I mean, maybe I could carry one or two, probably one depth charge, but that just seems to be silly. I can carry things that'll help other people do the job, which I think is ultimately what you would look for in a small unit, in a PC, if you wanted to deploy it in some sort of ASW capability.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, I mean, back in the old days, we had these mobile inshore undersea warfare units, which were mostly in the reserves. They may have, some of them got activated and became active duty, but one of the things they had was they had a van with a sonar setup and capability of reading the sonar buoys. We deployed not from PCs, but from basically RIBs. So, you know, you had the capability of going, and in fact, you could throw them off any, as you just noted, you could have thrown them off a bass boat if you wanted to. But, you know, we did have that capability, and we used it during Desert Storm. So it is something that the Navy has done before. They don't have to tie everything to huge gray hulls underway. So just a thought.
And here's another thought for you. Some of the guys are bringing it up on the chat room. Is one thing that's always kind of bothered me when we look at ASW, whether you're talking about small ships or larger, is we have kind of in our toolbox just a hammer, the lightweight torpedo, whether over the side or coming out of a helo or coming out of an Azeroth, so to speak. From a small boat perspective or from a surface warfare perspective, you know, how much confidence do you have in that one hammer? Or do you wish you had, instead of a hammer, maybe a hammer, a vice grip, and a reversible pair of pliers? Are there other ASW tools out there, especially in the littoral and in the coastal, that it might be value-added for us to reconsider maybe bringing on board? Yes, I'm picking on you, Matt.
No, that's quite all right. One of the things that I really liked that they brought up during the Warfare Innovation Workshop was the idea of a magnetic mine that wasn't really kinetic. It was just a little fan that charged an EMP. And as the ship would go, either it be a ship or a submarine, goes through the water, it would charge it up, and it would get just enough charge that, boom, it'd go off, things would break, they'd fix it, couldn't figure out why, they'd start moving again, and it would wait until it charges. So, yeah, it seems like the reliance on the torpedo is, I mean, especially with UUVs. We talk about UAVs, and there's the whole thing, there's some sort of ethical dilemma, even though they're essentially missiles that aren't dedicated to killing you the first round. Is that you could use UUVs and things like that, stuff that just hangs out and waits until the submarine comes by. Or one of the things that we discussed at the conference was the idea of submarines. For a while, people have talked about the idea of firing ASCM or anti-air weapons from a submarine, which, you know, in large part, people like that seems like a waste. It has torpedoes and the idea of putting, you know, hey, why not put a Connex box or some sort of waterproofed VLS cell under the water so you hide these things around a major strait or something like that and use something else to light it off, either a land-based command center or a submarine with some sort of data link to it underwater. It seems like we do really sit on kind of one capability that, I mean, I guess it's based on its accuracy and its effectiveness, but I mean, imagine how many depth charges you could buy for one modern day torpedo, and you could just kick them out the back of a C-130. I mean, I'm not an ASW guy. There's a reason I went to PCs. I love the surface warfare stuff. I love driving ships around really fast. But it does seem oftentimes that we're very monochrome in our approach to, I mean, for detecting submarines, but for killing the submarines themselves or even for disabling them, it seems like we have one way of doing it and that's it. We can put it on a rocket, we can put a propeller on the back of it, but it's pretty much a torpedo at the end of the day. I mean, here's something. So this is probably a bad plan. For all those who watch SeaQuest, I don't know why we don't have underwater planes by now. Not planes that take off, but something that stays like with lift under the water where a pilot, quote unquote, can actually see around. Now, that's useful futurism. I'm sure that some actual real life engineer has said it's a terrible plan. But you wonder sometimes, like, that seems really cool. Things like that kind of vaguely exist. Why wouldn't I want something that's moving so fast that you're really not going to shoot at it with a torpedo or have that ability to really fix it like a big traditional platform that maybe an amphib or a carrier can deploy and say, I think there's something over there. So little underwater plane goes flying away under the sea. But again, you know, I did grow up watching SeaQuest, so maybe that's the reason I'm thinking of this.
Either that or under your grandfather's bed, you found a bunch of 1950s-era Scientific American. Those magazines, the Tomorrow Today. But, hey, Matt, thanks a lot for calling in. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And do me a favor and please say hello to your lovely fiancé. The Navy is going to be better for having her associate even closer to it. She's a great find. Really happy for you.
Make sure that I stay in line, exactly.
Yes, sir. You got it. Appreciate
thanks.
It, Matt.
Yep, thanks. Bye.
Well, good. Dinner.
Marty,
must be my turn.
Yeah. It's your turn. I thought I would just pimp out the phone number one more time. If you'd like to call in, we've had Matt and Pinch on so far. Please give us a call. We'd love to have you. Our switchboard phone number is area code 347-308-8397. And for our friend in Turkey who really wants to call in, of course, that's country code 01 because this is America, 347-308-8397. Eagle One, to you.
Yeah, you know, speaking of the future with Matt there, one of the more exciting surface warfare stories of the last few days, another one of those great developments from our friends at the Naval Research Laboratory, the swarm bots they've come up with, where it looks like you can pretty much take your friendly neighborhood bass boats, go back to that concept, hook them together somehow through some kind of computer system and send out, I don't know, 10, 15 things in a swarm. They use them now to demonstrate the protection of vessels leaving harbors and stuff. But I did put up a blog post about this where I was a little more creative about how you could use these things. And it seems to me that what we need now is a carrier that can take, to keep along with Hipple's thinking here, take about 40 or 50 bass boats and hook them together in this kind of platform and send them out, as a mini task force, unmanned surface vessels, high speed, and then think of the weapon systems you could deploy on those. Send them up rivers. You can do all kinds of good stuff in the inshore waters with them. So I don't know. Do you have any thoughts along those lines? Is this like a P3 dumping little drones, 50 little drones to fly around, or is this a concept worth looking at?
I think it's an interesting concept, but I think it starts to flounder with the follow-on questions and the follow-on issues. It's kind of like, let's go back to a topic we talked about recently, harpoon. What when your lawyers start to get hold of your TAC man, and when you use harpoon, it's a non-discriminating weapon, as a lot of weapons are. It's fire and forget. You can't recall it. You can't, in most uses, you can't fiddle with a few of the finer details, and that leads you into ROE. You know, if you're going to put swarms out there with some type of AI into it, if they are going to be autonomous, what is their ROE? What are their engagement criteria? How does that need to be improved? How does that need to be approved? When does it turn itself off? Who controls that? Where is there a person in the loop? What type of reach back? If you're not going to have a truly autonomous system that can go through, okay, here's my ROE 1, 2, 3. Now I'm going to go and actually kill something. What type of reach back is that? Is it a two-way communications path? Because if you're going through the electromagnetic, unless you got everything connected by fiber optics, if you're using the global commons of the airwaves, somebody can jam it, somebody can spoof it, somebody can steal it, and then you really get to some limited capabilities. Where I think it is useful, and you brought up one of those topics, is so much of, at least on the tactical sense, that you need to think about when you're defending yourself, you can go to Mother Nature about. There are a lot of animals, large animals, or even smaller animals, that when they are threatened, they will put out a bunch of small, very irritating things to distract, do a mission kill. Perfect example, if you're as big of a geek as I am, you probably read an article online about the bird eater spider in South America. It's a big spider. It's the, you put two of your adult male hands together, that's about how big it is. 2-inch long fangs, mostly eats earthworms, though. It looks scarier than it is. But one of the things it'll do when you approach it is it starts rubbing its legs together along its back and its underside. What it's doing is it is sending out a bunch of small, almost invisible to the eye, a little cloud, a chaff cloud, of hairs that are irritating and painful to any mucous membrane. It won't kill you, but it will blind you. It will distract you, and that's how it gets away. You've got the squid that spits out a bunch of ink. Now, if you're looking to defend a large ship against a swarm attack, if you can throw out a bunch of small boats to distract them, to irritate them, to bounce into them, to generally make their situation more challenging, I guess you could do that. I'd really want to see it validated and proven. But it may be one of those, you know, interesting concepts, kind of like the nuclear bomber with nuclear engines that you can even build prototypes of. But when you do the follow-on question, that you start to see that maybe it's not as applicable as it should be. I would be more interested in taking that time and that money towards more hard kill capability, whether that's expanding a 50 cal or an anti-torpedo torpedo, or some type of directed energy weapon that can produce a soft kill or a mission kill on anything that has electronics in it. You know, if you've got 5 or 6 boats coming at you with a bunch of people waiting to go to paradise, if all of a sudden their engine stops working, they're just floating out in the water yelling at you, they're pretty useless and you can get along in your business. So that's, when you're looking at non-direct, non-kinetic ways of getting rid of your opponents that avoids having a great kit like a bunch of harpoons that you can't use because your lawyer goes, no, that doesn't meet these ROE serials. We got to get approval from X, Y, and Z to do that. So that's my general take on that. Sexy, but it doesn't survive the follow-on question.
I just have all kinds I think anything that makes it harder for the bad guys, especially bad guys that want to use swarms against you, fight them with your own swarm. We've got better bass boats than they do. So, I think it would be really interesting to test this whole thing out. And I hereby volunteer, if anybody from the Navy is actually listening to us, to take charge of this mission and buy a bunch of bass boats off Craigslist and let's run a few experiments with it.
Hey, I'm a big fan of experimentation. Why not? Hey, we got another caller. Let's go ahead and bring them on board. We've got area code 949. Welcome to Midrats.
Hey, it's X-Brad TC, Salamander, and I guess Eagles with you. Congratulations on 250 of these things.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Mr. X-Brad. And well, you've been around the Ponderosphere for a while as well. Really appreciate you calling in. Hey, take a moment for the listeners that might not be familiar with your site and let them know about it if they wanted to plow into it.
Okay, generally defense-oriented. I blog at Bring the Heat, Bring the Stupid, and the URL is xbradtc.com. Also have, as one of my co-authors, one of your front porch guys, I kind of poached him from you, Ultima Ratio Regis. So we touch on Army, Navy, Marines, artillery, ships, you name it.
We don't discriminate.
Yeah, we don't discriminate against the Marines.
No. Everybody needs a class clown. Everybody needs the village fool, so we're happy with them. But, hey, look, did you have a question or an observation for us today?
I was kind of wondering. I just came across an article that is discussing adding a dual-mode seeker to the Army's 155-millimeter caliber round, which I don't know if your listeners know. It's in service as a GPS-guided round right now and gives the Army guided artillery range out to about kilometers. And the piece also talks about Raytheon is trying to get the Navy interested in a 5-inch version for their, their standard mount. And from what I've seen, the Navy has expressed virtually no interest in an Excalibur-type 5-inch round, and I wonder if you know what's going on with that.
I've read about it, but I don't know what the progress is. So I'm afraid that unless Sal knows something totally brilliant on it, then it's an interesting concept. Love to explore it more.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd call my thought brilliance, but that never stopped me from commenting before. But I've actually touched
I have to toss you a bone every now and then.
I've actually touched on the topic a couple of times. The Italians have done some great work on that, down to their 76-millimeter round as well, that's kind of ubiquitous, to bring that extra reach. The last few years, there's been, I think probably it has to do with the carrier mafia in the Navy, but there always has been the redheaded stepchild treatment of naval gunfire by our Navy when we have people like the Italians coming up with greater options. And I think the Europeans, simply because from the sea, they don't have the carriers that we have, so they are looking for other ways to create effects ashore. And we saw during the Libya operations, especially the French, with their 100-millimeter, so, 5 inches, 127-millimeter. And our friend URR can pontificate about how can I put this without him calling in and making jokes, that every inch counts, so to speak, that going up from 3 inches to 5 inches to 8 inches, it's not linear. It's got a nice curve to it on the amount of explosive charge you can bring, or with what you're talking with the Excalibur round, is you exchange explosive force for guidance units, so you can have, I'm using very broad strokes here, you can have a 5-inch guided extended range round that maybe has the explosive power of a standard 3-inch round, but your circle area of probability is much tighter, which in the modern age, when you're dealing with a very populated and crowded world where you want to not have every explosion be 2,000 pounds from the air, perhaps a smaller, better aimed projectile will create a lower CNN effect. The Israelis have been very good with this as well, using precision guided attacks by both gun and missile from the sea at Gaza. The Italians and the French and some of the other European nations, I think, have perhaps brought it to a different level of discussion because they don't have the carriers that they can rely on to come across the beach. You know, we even saw during Desert Fox that there were a lot of targets that were taken out by carrier error that were taken out because that's who was doing the targeting. Probably would have been better just to take one of the ships, even with the 5-inch rounds that we had, and could have taken care of that for a much more affordable price. I think that, and we'll have to see what works with the DDG 1000 with their 155 millimeter or, you know, 6.1 inch, however you want to refer to it. I think they're very limited, though, on what type of projectiles they can use in that system. But it'd be interesting to see what type of reverse engineering. How much work or where are we from an Army perspective, X-Brad, with the Excalibur round? Are we through with the development that is actually deployable and operational, or is there still more work to be done?
Oh, the single channel, the GPS guidance, has been used in combat for about 2 years now. I don't think there's a single artillery battalion in the Army or the Marines that don't actively deploy it. I know the Marines took one shot in Afghanistan at a range of about 36 kilometers, and Raytheon has tested the current production block out to 54 kilometers. And one of the things that is frustrating to me about the Navy not showing interest in a Excalibur 5-inch round is that you get about double the range because they can shape the ballistic trajectory to extend the range of the round. So you would be looking at very minimal changes to the 5-inch 62, going from about a 13-mile range to a 25-mile range.
Now, what's the new seeker head that you referred to in the beginning part of your question? I didn't write it down.
They're looking at adding a laser spot tracker. So instead of just uploading a GPS coordinates and shooting and going for a fixed target, you'll also have a terminal guidance capability for moving targets.
Which would be really nice to have from a service perspective.
Sure. And I didn't think about it as an anti-surface warfare issue, but I suppose you could use that to engage ships.
Yeah, that's it'd be a little touchy, but you know, we were talking about anti-swarm attacks a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
Is sometimes if you can get those swarm those smaller targets at a distance, when you find yourself alone and unafraid and all you have is your helicopter, and that would probably be a nice capability to do before you went Winchester. But my guess would be that it's one of those things that you've got the money you've got, and you have to make your decisions what your priorities are and what is your unfunded priorities list, and that just hasn't broken above the ambient noise from the Navy's perspective. Yeah, that's something we've got to have now. Figured probably let the Army and the Marine Corps play with it, and if we want it sometime down the road, then we could look at reverse engineering it or steal what the Italians have done.
Okay, yeah. Again, I appreciate your time, and great to have you out there for 250 podcasts. That's incredible.
Yeah, we are like little chatty Cathys, but thanks a lot, Brad, for calling in, and I appreciate talking to you.
All right, you guys have a good one.
Yeah, thanks, Brent.
Here's a question. One of the things we brought up Eagle One on a not infrequent basis is we're always looking at, who in the House and the Senate up on the Hill, who are those advocates and who are those politicians that are really involved? And one of them is Representative Randy Forbes. And he's put out a couple of interesting things recently, one of which was he's kind of pinged on the Navy about not having strategists. And when I read that, I kind of cock my head a bit, because from my perspective, we do have some strategists out there. You know, one of which we have our friend, you know, Jerry Hendricks is left. We've got guys like Jim Holmes and Toshi Yoshihara and other guys that we've had here from the Naval War College, even some of our Navy compatriots that are off in Siberia, otherwise known as Kansas, with the Army. They're doing some strategic and operational level work. I don't know if it's the fact that we don't have any Navy strategists out there, or the fact that we're just not putting them in the right positions and they're not being hired and put in positions of authority, or after a decade of predominantly ground combat, whether they just really have a high enough profile, because to be blunt, people just aren't as interested. What were your takes on Randy Forbes? Did you get a chance to look at the letter or see some of the discussions about it?
Yeah, I did see that, and I thought, you know, somebody, we're spending all this, we have a lot of people invested in naval strategy, everybody from the people who were involved in the last naval strategy and the people who talk about it all the time and are thinking about it all the time, but it doesn't seem to go very far. I don't know where it stops or why it stops, but you know, I guess as you may be right. And I'm going to put in here that for those of you listening, we're going to go 90 minutes tonight. So if you think any minute we should have shut off 3 minutes ago, we didn't do it. So we're going to do an hour and a half. To get back to your question, yeah, I thought it was an appropriate question. You know, what is the Navy strategy? The Navy should point the finger upward. What is our national strategy? What do we want the Navy to do? It's not just that we operate in a vacuum. The Navy is part of a much larger enterprise, and I'm not sure we have a national strategy except that we're going to take global warming and global climate change, and we're going to wrestle that sucker to the ground and pin it. And until we do that, I guess everything else is on hold. But it's beyond me what national strategy the Navy strategy is supposed to be derived from at the present time. But that's just me.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think it's, if you want to ping on the Department of Navy for a lack of strategy, the Department of the Navy is only going to respond to the Department of Defense's demand signal unless you have, you know, personalities internal that really want to drive an issue, which I don't think we have. But ultimately, the Department of Defense is going to derive the direction from the Commander-in-Chief. If he wants a strategy, he'll get one, good, bad, or indifferent. If it's not one of his priorities, and if that demand signal is not coming out there, then you're not going to get one, and you're going to have pretty much what we have is what my father would call a bunch of strategic grab-assery going on, where there's no rhyme or reason, just a bunch of people running around in circles grabbing at what comes in front of them. It's just pretty much what we have right now. I think we have some very good and some very smart people who are out there trying to have the conversation. But until there's something put out there that people can get hold of, scratch and sniff, think about it, start to argue and discuss and to plan against it, I don't know. I don't think we can. I think facts are going to require us to do more of it, and a lot of it in a way that I think is very contrary to what the inclination is of a lot of people right now. Perfect example. Our NATO allies have put out a request recently that they would like to see more U.S. ships participate in the standing NATO forces and NATO operations, which I find intriguing when you look at the operations that NATO does, the defense of Europe, et cetera, and so forth. It's always, well, if we can't do it, America will. And they continue to undercapitalize their military. And just the assumption is that the Americans will do it. And we've also made some assumptions, because our budgets are under stress, where we want a 1,000-ship Navy. We want a comparative maritime, a cooperative maritime partnership. We want to rely on our allies. which was interesting when it was started a few years ago, but each year since then, the theory is so out of line with what is practical out there that I think when we get a real valid strategy that matches with resources, it's going to come as a lot of shock for people, and especially when it comes with our allies and what we can do. You know, east of Suez, I don't know if we're at one of those moments right now, but I think over the next 10 to 15 years, barring any significant degradation of the Chinese economy and the Chinese trends, that when we get through with the 2020s, which is going to be here before we know it, it's going to be very, very interesting to see how we and our traditional allies are going to look at our global strategy, which is probably going to look a lot more like 1910 than it's going to look like 1990.
Yeah, I don't see how. I mean, we've talked about this a number of times on the show and in our blogs. To have a strategy, you first have to know what the commitment is to fund the strategy. I mean, you know, strategy should drive your force, or your force ends up driving your strategy. And if that's the case, then what have you got? You've got, you know, are we a 200 ship Navy, a 300 ship Navy? And of those ships, 50 of them are going to be LCSs, which may someday prove to be really useful. Right now, that seems to be a lingering question. Are we going to, you know, are submarines more important to us? Or, I mean, what exactly is it we're trying to do, and how much money are we willing to spend on that? And some of that's got to be driven by some admiral who's going to stand up at some point and say, we can't do the missions assigned under the current strategy, whatever that is, with the assets we have. And I'm serious, you know, where do you want me not to do my job? And, you know, I've seen that happen in businesses. I've seen it happen when the guy on the workroom floor says, I can't produce the number of widgets you want in the time we have because it just doesn't work that way. I don't know why it's so hard for an admiral to stand up and do that, but apparently it is.
And Chris Rawley over in the chat room brings up a quote, and he also links to a Stripes article for it from Admiral Greenert. And I don't think we're going to have that. Vice Admiral Tom Connolly, you know, all the thrust in Christendom can't make this a fighter type of clear communication. Quote from Admiral from the article says, quote, Greenert said the need to leverage a global network of partner nations to achieve American aims will be a prominent theme in the revised strategy, period. I think that's a great discussion for peacetime operations, which what we're seeing is they're asking for more American units to participate than it is actually when things start shooting. We've covered this topic so many times. And it's uncomfortable when you're dealing with your allies because you quickly find yourself in the diplomacy arena vice the actual what can I do with these in a wartime situation. What we saw at the Horn of Africa, where you have 23 ships, of which only 7 you can really do anything with because of national caveats and ROE. You have, you know, one of my favorite episodes off of Okinawa. While the battle was raging, war in Europe ended, and one of the heavy cruisers was manned by Canadians, and they took a vote, and the Canadians said, "War in Europe over, we're going home later," and they left. Allies can do those things. Those that have deployed to Afghanistan and also to Iraq early on know very well that you can look on a sheet of paper and you have 3 battalions to work with, but in actuality you have a battalion and a third, because national sovereignty means that a nation is only going to do with their forces what a nation wants to do with them. And and I think you make a good point that if we know that we're being asked to do things we can't do with the resources we have, as opposed to looking for a comfortable Band-Aid to say we'll just leverage the ability of our yet-to-be-formed coalitions, do we need to just come out and say, we can't do it? Can't be done.
Well,
or we
I,
can
I am
do it, but then we can't do this.
I'm stunned. I mean, I saw this quote too, and I aren't you stunned by the fact that the CNO would say something like, "We're going to get the other guys to achieve American aims." I mean, if I'm an ally, I'm going, "What? I'm in this for my own aims. I don't know what your guys' aims are, but unless our aims are mutually compatible, no, I'm not in this for your aims." I mean, I'm just kind of stunned by that statement. I mean, I don't know. That seems a little bit odd.
Yep, and there's also the thing that we can't make assumptions anymore. Where at one point we could, that we could get on the phone and create a coalition, we all would be off and running. It doesn't work that way anymore. People are going to say
that,
no.
Who was that guest we had on who discussed, it was about Afghanistan, he was talking about all those caveats and you know, the difficulties of majority democracies as opposed to kind of democracy. You know what I'm talking about? The coalition, that we're not coalition.
Yeah.
What's the word? Where they have a small minority, a clump of small minorities who actually are the majority running a country. And, you know, he was a really good guest and an eye opener on how these things will not work. And should be a warning for the naval forces.
It is an absolute warning. I think one of the major things that I disagreed with Bob Work on was when he was saying the Navy doesn't need frigates. When the Navy needs frigates, we can get them from our allies. Okay, hold on for a second. Which allies and which frigates? Are we talking about some of the old Knox-class frigates? Are there variants that the Spaniards and the Turks have for a coalition? Or are we going to get a couple of modern Dutch frigates with no caveats? Are we going to get one of the new destroyers from the Royal Navy? Or are we having one of our former kid-class destroyers from the Taiwanese Navy joining in us? A frigate is not a frigate. And what if they do show up? Are they going to let you do what you want to do? Or if they don't show up and you still have a mission to do, but you don't have that frigate that was supposed to magically appear when you get off the phone, then you're going to have to take a ship that wasn't designed to do a frigate's job, and you're going to order them to do it, which is when we go back to my favorite bugbear, LCS. That's what we're going to do. We're going to take an LCS, whether we're talking about escorting tankers through confined waters, which actually they should be a pretty good ship for if they actually had a weapon system that was redundant and worked, or long-term presence off, we're going to put them in a position where you would normally have a good multi-mission frigate. And we're going to put sailors in a position to do things much longer than they were supposed to be, with not the weapons suite they need to do it, but sailors will do what they've always done. They'll do the best they can with the equipment they're given. And it's not so much setting people up for failure as it is through poor planning on your part, intentionally putting your sailors in situations that they have not been trained, manned, and equipped for. And that will happen because, ... it has happened before, and it'll happen again.
Yeah, cheerful. Say, speaking of cheerful things, how about those National Guard units that have been authorized to be called up to combat Ebola and perhaps in Africa? Got any thoughts on that?
I do. I can argue more in favor of President Obama's administration than I can those that are saying that he's wrong, and here's why. In a perfect world, sovereign nations would have capabilities to do things. Sovereign nations would be able to help themselves. We don't live in that world. There are things that the administration's not doing, but specifically with the National Guard units, we have a situation where, as usual, the call has come out from West Africa to help. And everybody looks to the U.S. Who's going to help? It has to be America because nobody else is going to do it. That's not really fair. The Brits have done some stuff. Some other nations have done some stuff. But the ground truth is we have a population of 313 million and change. We can do more than 65 million Brits, 17 million Dutch, 10 million Belgians, 25 million Australians. They can help. They can do things. But we have the ability to do what we have to do. Now, the choice of the National Guard units, that was a decision that came out of the Pentagon. They probably looked at what are the missions that need to be done, what units are available to go and have the proper skill sets. And for some reason, the answer popped out of the tube, these National Guard units. There are some people who find some dark angles to that. I don't. I think if there was something, some truth to what you hear at 2 in the morning on AM radio, that would leak out pretty fast because National Guards and Reservists are notorious for going into high warble if they're being abused. So I think the decision was made that maybe we can help contain the outbreak or at least lead from the front for the international community to say, hey, the U.S. military is here doing what it can. Will the rest of y'all get moving and help out?
Well, the Guard does have special units. I mean, we talked to somebody. Well, you know, we've been doing this show so long, and my memory is so bad. But the National Guard does have units that are designed for fighting or have been trained to handle chemical, biological, and nuclear disaster situations. And this seems to me to be a pretty good example of when you would want to use a unit like that. You know, I guess I'm not sure what the active duty component has that would be similar to that, if anything, but there is a force in the reserves and the Guard where there are specially trained units that deal with this stuff. So it's not quite as outrageous as some people have made it seem to be.
I think, and again, I haven't seen the documentation. Hopefully they're going to put it out in open source, and maybe it's been put open source. I just haven't been able to find it. But I would hope there's already in place a plan for those that are returning and coming home, that there's a respect for the incubation period. In an ideal world, there would also be a situation where civilians traveling from that part of the world would be under similar restrictions, because it's not as contagious as a lot of other diseases out there, but the economic disruptive capability of just a few people coming back and the amount of chaos that would take place at a large military installation. You know, Fort Hood, if Fort Hood woke up tomorrow with 3 cases of Ebola strolling around, from the on-base elementary school to everybody getting ready to deploy those large unit formations, the disruption would be off the hook. There's just so many areas that it can disrupt that I hope we do our due diligence and not have the military of 2014, 2015 have the same reputation as the U.S. military in 1918, 1919, which I think a lot of people know was largely responsible for the Spanish flu kicking off and getting moving as much as it was. Again, the hope is that good people and tough jobs are going to make smart decisions based upon what they're seeing there. So when people come home, they and their families are protected, because it is a challenging disease, especially when you're working in a real interpersonal environment. I think we'll be okay. I think there are good people who have a different opinion about whether we should be sending anybody into West Africa. But like I said before, I can more easily defend the administration's decision to do this than not. And if not the National Guard or Reserve, I don't know who else, without looking, what do we call it, the Rockpo, those individual units?
I think the thing that troubled me the most, having gotten into the disaster preparedness world, that, you know, in theory, like other theories, we had a structure set up to deal with situations like this. You identify, here's a situation where, you know, there's an outbreak of this stuff in Africa. And instead of kicking off the initial steps of what are we going to do if it comes to our shores, you know, are there special hospitals designated to deal with this, you know, how are we going to treat these people, how are we going to identify them, how are we going to screen people at the border, instead of doing that proactively at the start of this, which is in the disaster management world, what you want to do. I mean, you don't want to wait till the hurricane hits to decide that you're going to order the sandbags. You might need to shore up some beach someplace. I mean, this stuff has got to be in the pipeline. I'm astonished by the fact that this has been totally reactive. I mean, it's like, it's over there. It's not going to come here. We're going to announce that it's not going to come here. Then it does come here, you know, and then it's like, well, how in the world did this happen? You know, where was the proactive aspect of this? And it's very disappointing to me as a person who's been looking at this stuff for a few years now, that it was not a much more proactive response to the situation as it began to boil up in Africa. And, and not just the U.S. like this. Apparently the World Health Organization hadn't exactly been a ball of fire on this thing either. But I'm baffled by the reactive instead of proactive approach.
And, I mean, you hit on a very important topic here. What this should emphasize to a lot of people is the utter and complete failure of the national, international institutions whose job originally designed and used to do, you know, pretty good, look at the eradication of smallpox, but the organizations that got rid of smallpox are not the organizations that exist today. Whether you're looking at the CDC, the World Health Organization, and their fellow travelers, there's been an utter and complete failure of theirs. They've lost the bubble, and they have for years, and what their priorities are when, you know, the America's spending of millions and millions of dollars to study why lesbians have a higher incidence of obesity and why overweight women get asked out on dates less and have less sex. That's a fact. Your taxpayers paid for that. And that really is the bigger issue to me. And a perfect example of why it is a serious problem is you can often judge or at least make assumptions about peoples and organizations based upon who they hire, who they fire, and who they promote. And who did the Obama administration put in charge of their whole situation as their czar? They hired a lawyer who has a history of being a political staff fixer in the Democratic Party, which tells you they view this primarily as a political and a messaging challenge and not a public health challenge. This is a public health challenge, and a lot of the public health challenge has to do with educating people in such a way that they have confidence in the system. And one reason why people don't have much confidence in the system is the CDC was telling people what they wish the infection was, not what it actually was. Once you lose that confidence, it's hard to gain back. I think the president could have helped everybody if after the initial reaction was as ridiculous as it was, that he fired a bunch of people and put some people in there that would build confidence. I don't think Joe Biden's former chief of staff is going to build confidence that the nation has in its public health system, which is what worries me more than anything else. If people don't have confidence in the public health system, then you're going to wind up creating more problems than you're going to solve by being political about it. Going once, going twice.
I'm going to keep pushing the wrong button until I learn how to talk on this thing.
Yeah, I was going to give you a little advice about the mute button again, but I figured,
it's only been 200 some odd shows that I still don't know how to hit the right button.
Yes, Chris is right. Hunter Biden for the Ebola czar. He knows medication quite well. Very good point.
Well, let's talk about, you know, somebody's been raising Rickover over there. I'm sure it's BJA throwing some Rickover bombs because of the anti-STEM. He leads the anti-STEM movement in the United States Navy, Professor Armstrong. So should STEM, we've argued this before too, but how big a deal is STEM? Should we be sticking with this, you know, everybody's got to be STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, or, you know, how much space is there for the guy who majored in sociology or bat psychology? Where is that stuff going?
Well, if I can pimp my home blog, tomorrow I'm actually hitting that subject because
you have a blog?
We might be seeing a little movement of the knowledge of a little movement in the issue. The CNO has come out recently and looked like he's taken a second look at the STEM bias for ROTC scholarships, that 85% ridiculous number. You need an intellectual diversity, and as much as I love them, a bunch of engineers and mathematicians and physics are not what you need to solve a big problem. Yes, in theory, we're a technical organization, but as an officer, you're not a technician. You need officers who have a very strong technical background because you need engineering duty officers and stuff like that, but 85% of your wardroom does not need to be thinking in that context. So that's good that that's coming around. I wish that we found a way to be a little more neutral in how we give scholarships, because most of the big problems that we're dealing with and have dealt with don't necessarily involve science, technology, engineering, and math. They involve critical thinking. They involve looking at trends in societies and in cultures and in economics, how people relate, how people interact. And you also need to have enough people on staff that have a what I call a classic education that can help control the thoughts and inclination of those that don't. There's a difference between ignorance and stupidity. You can have some incredibly brilliant ignoramuses out there who simply, they've never studied history. Their idea of what has happened before is what has been in their conscious existence, because they really haven't taken any history since high school. And you need to have somebody at the table who can perhaps leaven the discussion when the unusual happens, or at least help direct the solution to problems by having studied what happened in 500 BC or 1950 or 1860. That's important to have. Everybody doesn't need to be a historian, just like everybody doesn't need to be a nuclear engineer. But you need that right mix, and I think we're heading that direction. I think we're coming to the bottom of our 90 minutes.
Yes, we are. At this point, we usually ask the guest what they have coming up, but you've already plugged what you've got coming up in your blog. You're going to talk about STEM. What else are you going to be looking at next week?
I'm going to look at Coastal ASW, and I have a couple. Yeah, so I've kind of done a little bit of show prep here. But a lot of it will depend upon what strikes my fancy for my real life. I have a very busy week, so it might be a little thin, but hopefully I can get a couple of ideas out there without being too repetitive. How about yourself?
Well, I don't know yet. I mean, I do the Disaster Wednesday and stuff like that, but I haven't decided yet where the Navy issues are going to go. I do want to take a couple of seconds here, since we have five left, to thank the people who've listened to us for 250-odd shows, and wish them all the best.
Absolutely, and now we're just talking to those that are getting us on the podcast. I want to thank everybody. It's been 250 episodes, and kind of like we discussed in the beginning of the show, if it weren't for all of our guests and for our regular listeners, I don't think that we'd have been able to keep going for 250. 250 is a big number there, shipmate, but It's also gone very fast, and it's been a pleasure. And hopefully we've created more light than heat, and I think we have.
I hope so. Anyway, it's a pleasure working with you, and let's go for another 250.
You got it. And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us on Sundays. We'll see you for the next 250. And until then, I hope you all have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the strand.